The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Daniel Gordas, Senior Vice President of the Shalem Center, author of the award-winning book Saving Israel, How the Jewish People Can Win a War That May Never End, and the website Dispatches from an Anxious State. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reform congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week, we finally completed our Jewish holiday season. You thought it would never end, didn't you? Me too. And now we're back to being Jewish without all those messy fall festivals to distract us. Since we've completed our Zman Simchatenu, our season of festive joy, we've had just about all the positive energy we Jews can tolerate in one helping, so it's time for me to unburden myself on a subject close to my heart. It's time for a major kvetch. Which brings me to my topic of the day, the new craze for so-called cultural Judaism. If you've been following the Jewish media of late, or the general media when it deigns to pay attention to Jewish topics, the latest fad explanation for why Jews don't actually act like Jews and do Jewish things, or perhaps more precisely, why Jews don't live their Jewish commitments, is that they are cultural Jews and not religious Jews. I have suddenly been hearing it in a variety of contexts, from families who don't send their kids to temple after bat mitzvah in spite of committing to do so in advance, from donors who don't want to give as much money as they did, from older people who just don't want to bother to come to temple, even from temple board members. I'm a cultural Jew. My favorite instance of this took place in a bar mitzvah lesson I was teaching, if you can believe it. A 12-year-old boy actually told me that he hadn't done his homework because he was, yep, a cultural Jew. It certainly is more inventive than the dog ate my homework, or your email didn't come through, or I don't have time because I play baseball. Wow. A 12-year-old cultural Jew whose existential angst precluded him from summarizing his Torah portion. Actually, in some ways, that's about right, because the concept of a cultural Jew is nothing more than a blatant excuse, and not a very convincing one, for simply not doing the things that responsible Jews do. In fact, the so-called cultural Jews I know were all raised in Jewish homes, attended synagogues, were bar bat mitzvahed, observed a variety of Jewish holidays like Passover throughout their lives. Suddenly, as adults, or even older adults, they've come to realize that their true fulfillment comes from being cultural Jews who can discern the essence of true Jewish sensibility by not doing Jewish things or supporting Jewish causes, you know, like synagogues or schools or the State of Israel. This trend has replaced the previous excuses for not being very Jewish or supporting Jewish institutions that for years included, I'm a secular Jew, or I'm just Jewish, or I'm Jewish, but I don't believe in organized religion. Now we have a new entry into the I'm too assimilated and self-absorbed to actually participate in the 3,500-year-old tradition I was born into sweepstakes. It's called cultural Judaism. Don't want to pay synagogue dues? Don't feel like driving your kids to Hebrew school or confirmation class? Would rather go to the gym than pray on Yom Kippur? You like bagels and lox, but not commitment? Don't want to mess with that irritating belief in God question? No problem. Abracadabra! You are now a cultural Jew! Fully Jewish, without having to do a dang thing. Oh, and best of all, no guilt. You have a title. Now, look, I'm not denying Judaism is a culture. Of course it is. The oldest and in many ways the deepest and most varied culture in human history. In fact, it's composed of several, even many cultures. Ashkenazic Jewish culture, Sephardic Jewish culture, Yemenite Jewish culture, Persian Jewish culture, New York Jewish culture, and so on. Each of which can be further subdivided into various cultural elements or motifs. But you know what they all have in common? Judaism. The Jewish religion, without which the culture is devoid of content and meaningless. When Mordechai Kaplan defined Judaism as a civilization 3/4 of a century ago, he was describing a fact, but one that was based on and indivisible from its religious core. The culture of Judaism, the cultures of Judaism are derived from and entirely dependent on the Jewish religion. There is no cultural Judaism without Judaism. There are no cultural Jews without Judaism. Nobody that I have heard of calls himself a cultural Christian or a cultural Muslim. Are there cultural Hindus, cultural Buddhists, cultural Hare Krishna? What exactly, by the way, are the core requirements to be a cultural Jew? Are you required to go to Woody Allen movies, Coen Brothers movies, eat only good bagels, work out with other Jews, have dinner on Rosh Hashanah? Vote Democratic for president? Are you supposed to complain about your kids? Read the New York Times online? Eat in delis? Listen to Barbara Streisand? Travel to your relative's bar and bat mitzvahs? Dance a wedding hora? Put up a mezuzah on your door, but leave it empty? Send at least one check a year to a Jewish organization, but not a large one? Buy a box of matzah for Passover, but not open it? Listen to Too Jewish once a month? How do you become a cultural Jew? My real experience has been that cultural Jews define themselves principally by what they do not do. They don't come to Shabbat services. They don't belong to a synagogue. They don't go to Israel, or if they go, they do it with a cultural, secular organization. You know, a cruise, or maybe one of those not too Jewish Federation trips. They don't observe Passover. They don't require their kids to choose Jewish education over other interests. They don't light Hanukkah candles. They don't pray. They don't study. They don't support Jewish institutions. They don't read Jewish books. And of course, it goes without saying, they don't keep kosher or light Shabbat candles. Cultural Judaism. Great marketing for the lazy and the cheap. If you don't feel like being actively Jewish, and certainly if you don't feel like actually paying money to support Jewish institutions, you don't have to explain that you are not religious. You don't have to admit that most of your approach to Judaism is negative and based on what you don't do. You just say, oh, I'm a cultural Jew. Nice work if you can get it. You can pretend to be fully Jewish, but not do anything that might inconvenience or, God forbid, challenge you. Of course, there's a small problem. The truth is that all it takes is one full generation of cultural Jews, and there will be no more Jews. In fact, the right term for cultural Jews is much older. It is bad Jews. As author Gerald Shapiro put it in his wonderful book, Bad Jews and Other Stories, which Peter Riegert made into a movie called King of the Corner, I come from a long line of bad Jews, an age-old dynasty of skeptics and know-nothings, eaters of pork chops and treif. When Moses was up on Mount Sinai getting the Torah, my ancestors were down below drinking and carousing. Bad Jews all, and I'm the latest bad Jew. The truth is, I do object to people choosing not to act in Jewish ways, abdicating Jewish responsibility, surrendering their fabulous heritage of meaning and purpose and goodness voluntarily. But you know what? It's their choice. I respect their right to be bad Jews. I just despise the hypocrisy of pretending it's something else, some sort of justified choice of an imaginary cultural Judaism. If you're going to be a bad Jew, not choose to do anything Jewish, defining yourself by what you don't do, contributing to the destruction of the Jewish people, at least own it. Admit your lack of commitment. You are not a cultural Jew. You are not a secular Jew. You are not just Jewish, and you are surely not a reformed Jew. You're just a bad Jew. I feel better now. Sort of. Perhaps we should play some culturally Jewish music now to ease us into the show. Here's an upbeat klezmer freilach from the jazzy Swiss band Kol Simcha. It's kind of a hora on speed. That was a speedy hora from the very talented and innovative klezmer group Kol Simcha. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Rabbi Daniel Gordis, who is clearly much more than a cultural Jew. He's the senior vice president of the Shalem Center, author of the National Jewish Book Award-winning work Saving Israel, How the Jewish People Can Win a War That May Never End, and he has very interesting things to say about the nature of Israeli and American Jewish life, more interesting than pretty much anyone else. Meet him when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, lots of people tell you how important breakfast is, but I think lunch is better. Look at it this way. When you go to lunch, you get to take a break from work. With breakfast, you're just taking a break from sleep. Another great thing about lunch, and this is important, Mama's Pizza is open for lunch, and we're not open for breakfast. So you can drop in at lunchtime and get a slice, a whole pie, or one of our delicious calzones. You can even get a piece of Mama's famous home-baked cheesecake for dessert. You can't do that at breakfast. Mama's has the perfect lunch atmosphere. We designed Mama's to be comfortable enough for a business meeting and casual enough for any group of friends. So try Mama's for your next lunch. Then, if you got any leftovers, save them for breakfast. Mama's Pizza, with four convenient locations, including our newest at Broadway and Houghton. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
We're delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, Dr. Daniel Gordis. He's a senior vice president of the Shalem Center. He is also a senior fellow there. By the way, how does it feel to be like a senior fellow? Doesn't that feel like it's too old for you in some ways?
I wish it was too old for me, but I've caught up.
He is a regular columnist for the Jerusalem Post, frequent contributor to the New York Times, has an excellent website and blogs, and he's the author of numerous books on Jewish thought. He is the current winner of the National Book Award for his most recent book, which is called Saving Israel, How the Jewish People Can Win a War That May Never End. He is perhaps the most interesting author on contemporary Jewish life from what I would say is a very well-informed American Jewish perspective. for an Israeli who has kids who serve in the army. Currently writing with Rabbi David Ellenson, a friend and teacher of mine and a former guest of Two Jewish, a book that is tentatively titled For the Sake of Heaven, Conversion, Law and Politics in the Modern World of Jewish Orthodoxy, and working on lots of other projects. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I have a confession to make. You were the founding dean of the Ziegler School of Rabbinic Studies, University of Judaism, where I decided not to go, having grown up in L.A. and then went to HUC. But it wasn't your fault.
Well, sorry that we missed you. But the good news is that there's a lot of good rabbinical schools out there, and talented people can go to lots of places.
Very, very appropriate comment. You have often written kind of challenging articles about the experience of being an American Ole in Israel. Tell us a little bit about why you finally decided to make Aliyah. You had a very prominent role in American Jewish life. Your family's had an important role in American Jewish life for a long time.
Well, the truth of the matter is, I don't think it's the answer that you want, but the truth of the matter is we made Aliyah because my wife informed me we were making Aliyah. And she wanted to, and I didn't want to, and we compromised and did. Now, that sounds like it's a joke. It's actually not. My wife was a diehard Zionist from the minute that I met her, and she had always wanted to do this. We got to a certain point in our lives, and I had had a stretch in my career that was what I wanted to do, and it was really her turn. And at that point, we were here for a sabbatical, having a wonderful year, and I, in all seriousness, did come very willingly, though it was very much her impetus.
In your pieces that you write about Israel, there is just a little bit of, I don't want to say ambivalence, but certainly the analytical quality that says, you know, life isn't perfect in the Jewish state, and here's what we ought to do to make it better. It's, of course, typical of Jews to criticize wherever they are, but I do sense a certain ambivalence about the perfection of Israel.
Of course you do. It's careful reading, and I appreciate that. Israel's not a perfect country. The United States is not a perfect country. France and England are not perfect countries. And I think that, you know, I'll use the model of parenting here for a second. You know, I have three kids. I love my kids. One's married, one's in the Army, one's in high school. I have a son-in-law who's also in the Army. The one in high school is about to go in the Army. They're all great kids. I adore them. They're really adults at this point. They're wonderful company. But none of them are the people that I hope they'll ultimately come out to be. They all have growing up to do, as do I, as does my wife. I think we all do. I think when you love something or you love someone, you want to see it living up to its potential. And to go back to the case of the state of Israel for a second, because I think so much of the future of the Jewish people hinges on what happens to and in the state of Israel, it's devastatingly important to me that Israel live up to its potential. It's not going to ever be a perfect country, obviously. Every country has crime, and every country has a certain amount of corruption, and every country has some pollution. Those aren't the kinds of issues that really worry me in the middle of the night, of course, although they're very, very important. But what really keeps me up at night is the question of, can different kinds of Jews learn to live together? Can Israelis, after not 62 years of war, but after 75 years of war, 80, 90, depending on when you start counting, almost a century of warfare with Arab neighbors, first informal groups, and then the standing Arab states, now the Palestinians, living at war for that long a time creates a certain callousness. It gets you used to the idea of war. It can get you to the point where you think that, well, my generation lived that way, my parents' generation lived that way, and their parents' generation lived that way, so my children and their children will have to live this way too, and I think that's very dangerous for a whole array of reasons. I'm not sure that Israel can sustain this for an infinite number of subsequent generations. So I worry about the part of Israel that is a little bit less anxious to make peace. It's not the whole of Israel, it's not the most of Israel, but there are parts of Israeli society that I'm worried about in that way. I'm worried about the overwhelming number of Haredim, ultra-Orthodox Jews, who, in my estimation, and not everybody agrees with me, but in my estimation, have a pretty parasitic relationship with the state. The state funds their schools, and the state funds their families, but they don't serve in the army, and they don't see themselves as part of the larger body politic. These are things that seem to me to be critically important as Israel forges ahead and tries to figure out what kind of a society it wants to be. And I don't believe that you do your best to raise your children by not pointing out their faults to them, and I don't believe that you're a good citizen necessarily by standing idly by. I'm very fortunate to have a couple of outlets, whether it's in the Post or the New York Times periodically or commentary this month or in books, whenever, you know, you get lucky. I have an opportunity to say some of these things out loud and to hope some people will join forces. I do it out of a love for Israel, not out of anything else.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Daniel Gordis when we come back on Two Jewish.
Choosing the proper care for your mother, father, or other loved one isn't easy. David Shackman and his wife Ann are New Yorkers who recently found a home at Handmaker, Tucson's premier provider of assisted living and senior care.
I'm 88 years old. My wife is 86. And we like staying at Handmaker because people here are very courteous and the atmosphere is nice.
Well, I like the program here because they have entertainers, have a bingo. They made a luau with Hawaiian dances.
Handmaker gives their son, Ken, peace of mind.
I know that they are going to get good service and the staff will treat them as friends.
Handmaker, centrally located on Rosemont just south of Grant, includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, and Tucson's most caring staff. Call 881-2323.
The food here is excellent. It's as good as any good restaurant in New York City.
For a consultation and tour, call 881-2323 or go to handmaker.org.
Tucson Hebrew Academy will hold a special night to honor Tucson rabbis Sunday, October 24th at 5 p.m. at the Tucson Jewish Community Center at the annual Tikkun Olam Awards Celebration with Master of Ceremonies Congressman Jim Colby and acclaimed guest speaker Rabbi Daniel Gordas. Renowned author and Jewish educator, Dr. Daniel Gordas is the founding dean of the Ziegler Rabbinical School in Los Angeles, senior vice president of the Shalem Center in Jerusalem, and an fascinating voice on Judaism. Show your appreciation and support for Tucson's rabbis, including Rabbi Kohan and Rabbi Holtz, by attending this celebration. Call Gina at 529-3888. That's 529-3888 to attend the Tikkun Olam celebration featuring Rabbi Daniel Gordas, honoring Tucson's rabbis, including Rabbi Sam Kohan, and supporting the Tucson Hebrew Academy, 529-3888.
Adult Jewish learning at Temple Emmanuel is meaningful, challenging, and fun. The Adult Education Academy of Temple Emmanuel welcomes you to our fall semester of classes starting this month. Study Kabbalah or Jewish history, Bible or Hebrew, Jewish music or philosophy, poetry or Talmud or Zohar, spirituality and ethics, all with the best Jewish instruction in Arizona. And don't forget our excellent basic and intermediate Judaism courses, the Jewish Book Group, Jewish Home and Family, Adult Bar and Bat Mitzvah and Confirmation, and the Jewish Movie of the Month. Find out everything you always wanted to know about Judaism just by calling 327-4501. Classes are open to everyone and are taught daytime, evening, and weekends by outstanding rabbis and scholars like Rabbi Sam Kohan, Rabbi Jason Holtz, Rabbi Richard Safran, and other great teachers. Our classes are also available by podcast. Call 327-4501 for a brochure or to sign up. Remember, learning is the primary Jewish act, and Temple Emmanuel has the best way to do it. 18 new courses are starting in October. Sign up now for the Adult Education Academy of Temple Emmanuel fall courses by calling 327-4501 today.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2jewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at 2jewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows by contacting us through the website, 2jewishradio.com, or downloading us at the iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. Two food-related stories this week, both of which call into question the Jewish relationship to one of our favorite activities, eating. The first comes from New York, where apparently there is now a new tax, or at least they're starting to enforce it. Whole bagels that you buy are not subject to sales tax, but if you slice them or dare to eat them hot and whole in the bagel store, they are. It amounts to 8 cents per sliced bagel, which is a very unkind cut. Perhaps worse than a bris, when you think about it. In New York, they are making it harder to buy and eat bagels? Oy. If that weren't enough, in Israel, there's a new cookbook called The White Book. It is, well, a Hebrew language, Israeli-published pork cookbook. As its author, Dr. Eli Landau, says, people are reluctant to cook pork at home. I want to make it easier. The article goes on to say that he is not an observant Jew. Really? No kidding. Reminds me of when I lived in Jerusalem and went into a fancy deli once to buy a gift. I saw meat in the display case that I had not seen in Israel and asked the proprietor what it was. Basar lavan, he said, white meat, which was what they called pork in Israel in those days, to avoid the stigma of its intense non-kosherness. Basar chazir, he added, pig meat. And now Israel has its very first pork cookbook. What is this world coming to? We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart of the Israel Center. Boker Tov. Good morning, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. How are you today?
I'm well. So Hebrew was an ancient language. We all spoke it, that is, we Jews, up until 2,000 years ago, and then no Jew spoke it for like 1,800 years. We studied it. We prayed it. It was revived as a spoken language in the 19th century, and the man usually given the credit for it is a man named Eliezer ben Yehuda, whose grandson was here. So tell us a little bit about that visit and what we learned.
Thank you very much for raising up this subject. Yes. A while ago, Eliezer ben Yehuda, the grandson of the Eliezer ben Yehuda, came here to Tucson and had an amazing visit. He went to the THA and also met students from the U of A, telling them about his personal story as the grandson of Eliezer ben Yehuda and about his grandfather. An interesting question is, why did Eliezer ben Yehuda revive the Hebrew language? And the simple answer was that when Eliezer ben Yehuda was a young man growing up in Europe, his life as a Jew were not easy because non-Jews, well, they didn't like Jews over there.
Tremendous anti-Semitism. Sure.
To put it in his words, he got beat up when he went to school, he got beat up when he went on the street, and he was fed out of it. And one day, he had a dream. And in his dream, he saw a country where all the people are Jews, so nobody beat them up. And how did he know from his dream that all the people are Jews? Because they all spoke Hebrew. And that brought him the idea of reviving the Hebrew language. But what seems to us as a very natural and easy thing to do wasn't so easy, because the Hebrew language was originally created at the time of the Bible. Many modern things like ice cream,
eyeglasses,
trains, computers, so trains, right. Carriages did not exist at that time. So Eliezer ben Yehuda needed to go gather books and create new words according to the language rules. Now, the important thing about that is before that, all the Jewish people were spread in many diasporas across the world. And in order to create a Jewish state in the country of Israel, we needed a mean of communication between Jewish people. And the revive of the Hebrew language created this situation when we can speak. Moroccan Jew can speak with American Jew, with German Jew, and so on. And we thank Eliezer ben Yehuda for his great contribution.
It's a really miraculous fact. Here, the country of Israel, 7 million people speak Hebrew today. If you want to speak to a Jew anywhere in the world, you speak Hebrew, not Yiddish, not English, not French. And yet, 110 years ago, even 120 years ago, certainly, that would have been a dream, as crazy as the idea of a Jewish state.
Thank you very much. And it shows us how one man can really change the world.
Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant on the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Janos has been such a splendid restaurant now for a number of years. Not too many other places to go for that kind of meal, are there?
You know, less and less options all the time. That's one of the things that I'm proudest about. Great food, exquisitely prepared, terrific service, really personal. That's what we do. We prepare the best and bring it to you here in Tucson.
It's really fine dining, but with a special Southwestern local flavor.
Fine dining, Southwestern flavor, and really personal.
So if you want a special meal for yourselves, for guests, for anyone, what's the number to call, Janos?
615-6100. The website, janos.com. I know you like this, Rabbi. You can follow us on Facebook, too.
Thanks, Janos. I will look forward to seeing you there and anyone else who wants a great dining experience.
Rabbi, thank you.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, this is not exactly an international issue, but it hits on an international theme, anti-Semitism. A guy named Rick Sanchez just got fired last week. Let's talk about that.
What is international in a way? Because Rick Sanchez was one of the main sources of international news on CNN, and he was a very good anchorman, in my opinion. He recently made comments which I did not hear firsthand, so this is from reading and hearsay, but apparently made comments specifically referring to Jon Stewart, but more generally to the effect that the media in this country are controlled by Jews. And this is a widely held belief based on the notion that the New York Times is completely run by Jews and network TV and Hollywood and all that. And you know, whether there's even a grain of truth in this remains to be demonstrated, at least to me. But there is a widely held belief that the media are controlled by Jews. And Rick Sanchez claimed that Jon Stewart and all the other Jews in the hierarchy, and obviously any statement that begins with all the other Jews is obviously going to be false. But that
since
they
we
all
don't
have,
agree about anything right, in the first place.
They all have a bias against Hispanics, and he is Cuban-American from Miami, and that was one of the many things that gave him a rich and diverse perspective. He claims that throughout his career, he has been hurt by discrimination emanating from the Jewish mafia that controls the media, and CNN immediately fired him. Within hours, minutes maybe, suggesting that even if CNN clearly is not controlled by Jews, it is certainly sensitive to the power of public opinion and doesn't want an overt bigot, even if he was complaining about the bigotry of others, on its staff. Now, you know, there are a lot of directions in which you can take this, but one of the interesting things is we're always quick to condemn what we perceive as anti-Semitism in France or Germany or whatever. We sometimes forget to take a cold, hard look at anti-Semitism in our own society. And I don't mean things like a major university which schedules an important function on the evening of Yom Kippur because nobody bothers to look at a Jewish calendar. And I don't mean a major political party headquarters that makes calls to would-be supporters asking for donations on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, which is just thoughtless and ignorant, but not necessarily anti-Semitic. I mean statements to the effect that all Jews are cheap, or all Jews talk too loudly, or the media in this country are completely controlled and dominated by Jews. I mean, any statement that begins like that, and you can change the noun, it can be, you know, all gays, all African Americans, all whatever, is a statement that needs to be looked at closely, and the feelings behind it also need to be examined closely, in my opinion.
You know, all Jews would agree with that, Tom. I want to thank you. You know, maybe we'll talk next week a little bit about some other places where anti-Semitic issues crop up within America, because we have this perception that we're above that now. We're past anti-Semitism in America, or at least some of us do, and it's not exactly true. We'll talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to having that discussion.
Thanks, Tom. And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. The first Jewish president calls his mother in Queens and invites her to come for Hanukkah to light the menorah in the White House. "I'd like to," she says, "but it's so much trouble. First I have to get a cab to the airport, and I hate waiting on Queens Boulevard." "Ma," he says, "I'm president of the United States. I'll send Air Force One." "Yeah, but when we land, I'll still have to carry my luggage to the airport and then to find a taxi, and you know how holiday crowds are." "Ma," he says, "I'll have a helicopter pick you up. You'll go straight from the chopper to my front lawn." "I don't know. I'd still have to get a hotel room. Hotels are so expensive, and they're not like they used to be." "Ma, you'll stay at the White House. The White House." "Well," she sighs, "I guess. Okay. I'll come. For you." That afternoon, she's talking on the phone with a friend. "What's new?" the friend asks. "I'm visiting my son for Hanukkah." The doctor, her friend asks. No, the other one. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the great portion of Lech Lecha, which includes God's commandment to Abram. Lech Lecha, me'artzecha u'mimoladetcha u'mibeit avicha. Leave, go from your country and your homeland, the house of your father, to a land that I will show you. It is the beginning of monotheism, the belief in one God. It is the beginning of Judaism, and it will prove to be the beginning of our connection to the land of Israel as well. A dramatic, powerful moment. The fascinating thing about Lech Lecha is not that God commands Abram, later to be renamed Abraham, to leave everything he has known. After all, if he is to create a new religion and remake belief in our world, he will need to leave polytheism and pagan society, which doesn't want to recognize the concept of supreme justice and divine power. If you wish to live a life of goodness and blessing, you need to leave home. So Abraham picked up and left the sophisticated, morally challenged city-states of Babylon. He journeyed outward to find God and to found a new religion. That journey of differentiation was pivotal to all human history. If Abraham doesn't just do what God commands, there's no Judaism, or Christianity, or Islam, or monotheism, or really Western civilization. But what's most fascinating about Abraham's actions is that after God commanded him to go, he simply went, without argument or controversy. That strikes me as a very un-Jewish approach. After all, the essence of Judaism often seems to be argument and discussion. If you were directed to leave everything you'd known and told to move somewhere unspecified, wouldn't you at least complain a little? And please don't think Abraham is incapable of arguing with God. He proves in next week's portion he'll argue and bargain with God to the last degree, trying to defend the few righteous people of Sodom and Gomorrah. No, something else is at work. The essential understanding that we all have, that sometimes you just have to move on. Leave what you know. Embrace the journey. In order to fully realize who we can become, we must first leave who we have been. It's an exciting, exhilarating, daunting prospect. Dangerous, yet essential. If we choose to take the first steps, we may, like Abraham, reap rich reward. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Danny Gordis, is one of the most impressive voices on life in Israel today and its implications for the future of Judaism in the world. Find out how he thinks we can save Israel when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Handsome Hollywood matinee idol Tony Curtis, a Hungarian-American Jew whose given name was Bernard Schwartz, died last week at the age of 85. Tony Curtis, who grew up in the Bronx in a dysfunctional home, made it huge in the movies in the 50s and 60s, starring in such films as Some Like It Hot and Spartacus. He was also famous for his marriages to actress Janet Leigh, his daughter is actress Jamie Lee Curtis, by the way, and five other women, not at the same time, and some well-chronicled affairs, including one with Marilyn Monroe. The blue-eyed Curtis, upswept black hairstyle, was copied by Elvis Presley, by the way, who did pretty well with it. Tony Curtis, who spent part of his youth in an orphanage and whose brother was killed by a truck, remembered frequently getting caught up in gang warfare in the Bronx growing up and being the target of anti-Semitic attacks. He learned to protect his face, which even then he knew was his ticket to fame. Curtis served in the Navy in World War II, was present in Tokyo Bay, he was then Signalman Schwartz, and saw the Japanese formal surrender through binoculars. Tony Curtis was proud of being Jewish, and he surely never lost his Bronx accent. Who can forget the way he said, Spartacus? It sounded so convincingly, Roman? The two most prominent Jews in the Obama administration will both be gone soon. Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel left last week, and senior political advisor David Axelrod leaves within the month, which raises questions about the face of an administration that has worked hard recently to stay close to its Jewish support. Whether this will prove to be a cosmetic change in the Obama administration more than a policy change remains to be seen. But it was fun having a White House Chief of Staff's kid's bar mitzvah while he was serving there. Spain and Britain will boycott an international tourism conference being held in Jerusalem. The two countries will not send delegates to attend the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development's biannual tourism conference held in Jerusalem October 20th to the 22nd. Normally holds its gatherings on sustainable tourism in Paris. The delegates demanded that the conference not be held in eastern Jerusalem or that it be moved to Tel Aviv, Israeli Tourism Minister Stas Mysezhnikov said. Israel rejected the Tel Aviv proposal but agreed not to bring delegates to eastern Jerusalem, but this did not prevent Spain and Britain from withdrawing participation in the event. Palestinian groups have been applying pressure on members not to come to the conference if it's held in Jerusalem. I strongly denounce the states that surrendered to threats, Mysezhnikov said, but the conference, with 21 ministers attending, will take place as planned in Jerusalem. Delegates from at least 14 countries, Austria, the Czech Republic, Denmark, France, Germany, South Africa, the Netherlands, Poland, Slovakia, Slovenia, Sweden, Switzerland, Estonia, and Turkey, are all expected to take part in the conference. And in circumcision news...
Now it cuts like a knife!
This may have been the unkindest cut of all. In Haifa, Israel, a rabbi is suspected by the chief rabbinate of improperly doing circumcisions by failing to remove the entire foreskin. This has dozens of concerned parents very worried and may force the boys involved to undergo another procedure to correct the mistake. In words of one syllable, oy vey. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish This Morning our guest, Dr. Daniel Gordas, Senior Vice President of the Shalem Center, also a senior fellow there, regular columnist for the Jerusalem Post, contributed to New York Times, Commentary Magazine, recent winner of the National Jewish Book Award for Saving Israel, How the Jewish People Can Win a War That May Never End, and, well, you know, kind of prominent in a variety of media. So you said earlier that there's, you know, not everybody, but there's certain outpost sectors of Israeli society that really are essentially not involved with even the concept of peace anymore. But it's not really just sectors of Israeli society when Avigdor Lieberman is your foreign minister, is it?
Well, I really do think it is. I mean, the nature of Israeli politics and the nature of the Israeli political system is that relatively small parties can exert an inordinate amount of influence because they have a certain number of wedge seats that actually enable their coalition to keep over the 61-member of Knesset mark. I don't think that Avigdor Lieberman represents any significant swath of Israeli society. Parts of him speak to different groups of people. He's Russian by origin, so some Russians feel an affinity to him. He's highly nationalist, and that speaks to some Israelis, though not most, and especially of a younger sector. He attracted an inordinate number of people from the very young 18 to 22 sector when he was elected. He is distinctly not only not religious, but almost anti-religious, not anti-religious people, but anti the religious establishment. And there are Israelis who disagree with his foreign policy who very much like his push for civil marriage and for curtailing the role of the rabbinate and so forth. So he's able to cobble together enough different sub-elements that put him in the position that he's in. And because he's got a critical number, a small number, but a critical number of seats, he has much more sway than he might have. I mean, if Bibi Netanyahu wanted to get rid of him, he could, but he would then lose Lieberman's seats in the coalition. He'd have to replace them with someone. And the person that he'd have to replace them with, of course, is Tzipi Livni.
Right.
And Netanyahu and Tzipi Livni just don't see eye to eye about virtually anything. And I think neither of them relishes the idea of working together. She's waiting for him to fall, and he's waiting for her to be willing to join the coalition without insisting on sharing the prime ministership. So he's keeping Lieberman as kind of a lesser of two evils. You could argue, as many people do, that it's a mistake and that he ought to, out of a matter of pride and dignity, get rid of a foreign minister who publicly undermines him at the United Nations. That's a very fair argument, I think. But to suggest that Lieberman really represents a wide swath of Israeli society, I think is probably giving him credit for more support than he ultimately has.
So this is really silly to be talking about personalities in Israeli politics, because Israeli politics changes every 10 minutes. But it does seem that actually Netanyahu and Livni just can't stand each other, doesn't it?
It seems that way. It does seem that way. I think, I can understand her position. She felt she won the popular vote, so she should be prime minister.
Right.
And from her perspective, if he was able to cobble together a coalition and she was not, the least he could have done was to say, well, okay, you got the most number of votes. I'll split the prime ministership with you. Having said that, he said, well, why should I do that? I mean, you know, you got more votes than I did, but you couldn't put together a coalition. At the end of the day, the right-of-center coalition is what the vast majority of voters voted for. And that, of course, is the doing of the Palestinians, not the Israelis. It's the Palestinians who destroyed the Israeli left. She's not left. She's more center, but it's just an aside. So he didn't want to do it. And I think some of it's personal animosity. Some of it is that he thinks she's going to be too quick to cave on some issues of security that are critical to Israel. So as long as he's got the mandate, he's going to protect the country. And she probably thinks that he is insufficiently committed to the peace process. Well, I'm not sure that that's fair. I think that's what she would say. And so, there's no love lost there, and they disagree about a few things. And so far, they are not doing much together. But as you know very well, if Lieberman were to be forced out, or Lieberman were to do the next thing, which we can't even begin to imagine, which would make it simply untenable for him to remain as foreign minister, then Netanyahu would have no choice. He'd have to get rid of Lieberman, and either Tzipi Livni would come aboard, or she'd hold him over a barrel, in which case she'd be wagering that if there was elections, she'd do better. That seems to me to be not at all a foregone conclusion.
No, I don't think that's realistic.
Go for it.
Well, you know, I've seen so many, blood enemies in Israeli politics end up, not quite literally in bed together, but sharing prime ministerships and standing arm in arm.
That's true, but look at American politics. You have Hillary Clinton being the
vice president, the Secretary of State for Barack Obama, right?
But she's the Secretary of State for the person against whom she ran for the Democratic nomination.
Everybody
knows that the animosity between her and Obama during the campaign was very, very deep and personal. And now they work together, it would seem on the surface, at least reasonably smoothly. So politics are like that in all countries. I don't think that's unique to Israel.
Okay. So how can Israel be saved? How could the Jewish people win a war that may never end? And do you really believe this war will never end?
Well, no, I don't believe that the war will never end, but I believe it's not going to end in the foreseeable future. In other words, here, ironically, even though I thought his speech at the United Nations was outrageous and unfortunate, I actually don't think he's entirely wrong. I think that the Israelis are not perfect, and Israelis have not made every single move right. But I really do believe that, though most people think this is an oversimplification, I do believe that the bottom line is that the reason there's not peace in the Middle East is because the Arabs have not accepted the idea that there's going to be a Jewish state here. Even Abbas today, while he's negotiating, has made it very clear he's never going to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And some people think, well, that's kind of ridiculous. Who cares what he calls it? I don't think it's ridiculous at all. I think the bottom line is if Israel's not a Jewish state, for example, then there's absolutely no moral grounds for not admitting back the hundreds of thousands or millions, depending on how you count, of refugees living in Lebanon. The only reason that Israel has refused to allow them in is because immediately Jews would become a minority in this country. Now, why should the Jews not be a minority if it's not a Jewish state? So I think that at the end of the day, the Palestinians now, the Arabs prior, have simply not been able to internalize the idea that a Jewish state in the largely Muslim Middle East is a fact. And so I think that, unfortunately, it's going to take a lot more work. And I think in addition to that, there is the whole issue of state building. By the time Ben-Gurion declared the independence of the State of Israel on May 14, 1948, the Yishuv, which is the word that was given to the pre-state entity, had had years of doing the work of pre-state work. There was a tax system, and there was a civil service system, and there was an educational system, and there was transportation. All of the elements of government were basically running, and corruption, believe it or not, was very, very, very minimal, and it was reasonably transparent. That's a very, very, very far cry from where the Palestinians are today. They're making progress, but I think it's going to take a good number of years for them to get their organisms of state in place so that when they ultimately do declare a state, which I hope that they will down the road when everybody's ready for it, that they'll actually be able to sustain it. So I don't believe that the conflict's going to go on forever. I unfortunately don't believe that the conflict's going to be over as quickly as many would like it to be. And I want to stress, as you pointed out before, that I have personally very serious reasons to want it to be over. I've got a son-in-law in the Army. I've got a son in the Army. I've got another son about to be drafted. You don't need to have that many members of your family in the Army to desperately want there to be peace. But I'm just fearful that it's not as close as we might like. And therefore, in answer to your question, I think what Israelis need to do is Israelis need to be rearmed with a sense of purpose. You know, revolutionary zeal is a very, very hard thing to sustain for generation after generation. The Americans did it in the 1760s and the 1770s and a little bit in the 1780s. But today on American college campuses, there are all sorts of pressing issues. But the American Revolution and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are not the kinds of issues that people are debating on a day-to-day basis. And that's true of lots of revolutions all across Europe. Eventually, the revolutionary fervor dies down because the country simply becomes a fact. Israel doesn't have that luxury. Israel does not have the luxury of raising its children without ideological fervor and without passionate philosophic debate, because our country is in a lot of ways not yet a fact. It's not accepted by its neighbors. It does not have internationally recognized borders. It is increasingly marginalized in the international community more than accepted. So there's a whole array of reasons that young Israelis need to be armed with a sense of here's why the Jews need a country, and here's why sovereignty actually changes everything for the Jewish people. And in the book that you were kind enough to mention, Saving Israel, How the Jewish People Can Win a War That May Never End, what I seek to try to do is to explain what it is that Israel actually does for the Jewish people, how Israel gives the Jewish people, not just in Israel, but everywhere on the globe, a new lease on life, a new sense of optimism, a new sense of national rebirth. It gives Jews everywhere a very different kind of existence than we would have if we didn't have a sovereign country.
I want to thank Rabbi Daniel Gordis. I guess we call you Dr. Danny. We can call you a lot of things, but either way, it's been a great visit. Love to continue the conversation. His book is called Saving Israel, How Jewish People Can Win a War That May Never End. And if you live in Southern Arizona, he'll be here for the Tucson Hebrew Academy event in a couple of weeks. Danny, thanks for a great visit.
It's really a delight to speak to you. Thanks so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
Adult Jewish learning at Temple Emmanuel is meaningful, challenging, and fun. The Adult Education Academy of Temple Emmanuel welcomes you to our fall semester of classes starting this month. Study Kabbalah or Jewish history, Bible or Hebrew, Jewish music or philosophy, poetry or Talmud or Zohar, spirituality and ethics, all with the best Jewish instruction in Arizona. And don't forget our excellent basic and intermediate Judaism courses, the Jewish Book Group, Jewish Home and Family, Adult Bar and Bat Mitzvah and Confirmation, and the Jewish Movie of the Month. Find out everything you always wanted to know about Judaism just by calling 327-4501. Classes are open to everyone and are taught daytime, evening, and weekends by outstanding rabbis and scholars like Rabbi Sam Kohan, Rabbi Jason Holtz, Rabbi Richard Safran, and other great teachers. Our classes are also available by podcast. Call 327-4501 for a brochure or to sign up. Remember, learning is the primary Jewish act, and Temple Emmanuel has the best way to do it. 18 new courses are starting in October. Sign up now for the Adult Education Academy of Temple Emmanuel fall courses by calling 327-4501 today.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Arthur Kurzweil, the author of Kabbalah for Dummies, and a highly innovative and entertaining guy. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli-American artist Noah and her song, Now Forget. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Give me your pain, give me your sorrow, give me your loneliness and broken dreams, your bad times, your worry. Now forget, now forget. Give me your past, give me your family, give me the walls you build and the ones you break. Shadows and your longing. Now forget, now forget. All that will be, but is it yet? Now forget, now forget. I'll put it all in a small wooden box, with the rusty old lock and the sparrows in flight. I'll guard it with my life through the long, long night. You are my eyes, you are my passion, you are my journey to where I've been.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.